With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey guys, we got an ad. It's from superyaki.com. If you haven't been there yet, you really should go. It's this really cool website. You can go there. They have shirts for really great movies, also bad movies, but you know, the movies that Film Twitter says you shouldn't like, but they're a bunch of idiots because of course you like National Treasure. Of course you think Judy Greer is awesome. Of course you want pins with Sofia Coppola, which I think is down okay with Film Twitter, and also Jordan Peele, definitely okay with Film Twitter. Go to superyaki.com and buy your shit. I know Phil has a bunch of stuff from superyaki.com.
I have a bunch of shirts. I've got a written and directed by Rian Johnson shirt because I'm obviously a big Last Jedi fan. They got great Crimson Peak shirts, which is a fucking great movie that nobody talks about nearly enough. Their shirts are really soft. They're eco-friendly, water-based inks. They ship with compostable poly mailers for environmentally friendly alternative to online shopping. It's a great website. They're a great company. Karen Hahn, past and future guest, has a couple shirts that she's done with them as well, which is fantastic. And as a special gift to you, listeners can save 10% on their order with the code SUPERFRIEND, all caps, no spaces, at SUPERFRIEND at checkout.
Can you believe this? You listen to our podcast and you get 10% off shirts and sweatshirts and pins and bags from superyaki.com. This is a win-win for everybody, and we get none of that. Zero.
It's superyaki. That's SUPERYAKI.com.
See you at the movies.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? 1999.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from the Patronus Towers here in 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybarp.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And joining us today is the queen of shitty 1999 movies, Jessica Ellis.
Hi, glad to be back.
She's now also the queen of shitty internet because this is our third time going through this. It's hard doing this shit over Zoom and Zencaster, but thank you so much for bearing with us, Jessica.
Thank you
for coming back.
I am so happy to be here for another fantastic film. You guys offered me the best opportunities to visit the worst films.
This was our fault. I didn't know because it just shows up. Phil puts it together.
Well,
and
I mean,
Jessica Ellis wants to do entrapment, and I'm like, great. Jessica has great taste, and I'm sure she doesn't want to do another bad movie like she did last time. So I'm looking forward. Maybe this is a hidden gem.
To be fair, Phil sent me a list all of the movies on it were terrible.
Well,
but this one I had a horrible experience with. So he was like, let's do that one.
Well, basically, Jessica was like, I sent her the list and she was like, well, I have a really terrible story about Entrapment. I was like, well, that sounds great. I mean, how could we go wrong? And then I will also say, too, and I think you felt similarly to me, Kenny. Neither of us saw this film in 99, but neither of us thought it was going to be this bad. Like, both I went into thinking like, this will be just a middle of the road, pretty shitty but fine action movie from the late 90s. This is horrifically bad.
Extremely bad.
Well, as I said on a previous podcast, this is the this movie has been whittled down in pop culture to one gif. Right?
This of her ass, gift. Unfortunately.
Ass, yeah.
Going under what I always thought was a laser, but it's actually just a piece of yarn.
I thought the same thing, too. I was like, it's not even a laser.
It's just a piece of yarn. But that's what everybody, has taken away from this movie the last 21 years. And we're here to tell you that is the best part. What can I say?
It's a piece of red string with bells attached to it.
It's a bad movie. So, Jessica, before we go on, last time you were on the podcast, there were two very noteworthy things that came up, none of which had anything to do with Anne of the King. One is you're a writer, producer, director, and you had finished a movie called What Lies West. I'm a shithead. What Lies West, you have since entered it into film festivals. It has gotten into film festivals, correct?
Yes, yeah.
But, you know, obviously the plan was different. You expected people to be sitting in theaters and watching this movie.
Yeah, the first couple we got to have actual theaters full of people, and that was great. Our last festival, they canceled last minute because it was in... I feel like it was at the end of March or the beginning of April. I can't remember. It was 17 years ago. I don't remember. Sure. So we did a whole online thing, which is weird because it's like you still try to like rile up an audience and get an audience to buy tickets and stuff. And then it's just like deafening silence. Yeah. It's like, all right, everybody watch it, I guess. I don't know. Like, go ahead. So
we're all trying our best here and it's just not good enough. I feel.
I will say it was nice because the film has a big like Twitter support base who aren't able to go to where we've been at film festivals. So it was nice that people could actually buy tickets and go see it online and actually see the thing they donated to campaigns for and have not all gotten their rewards for yet because I'm very bad at those things. But yeah, it was weird. Film festivals are going to be weird for a while.
Well, that's good. Congratulations on getting into the film festivals. And hopefully, you know, the next step is distribution. And we'll see it on, Hulu, like Palm Springs. So that'll be great.
Yeah, it's just like Palm Springs. It actually is exactly like Palm Springs, except it's about two girls.
My understanding is it's like a feminist hiking movie.
It is, yeah, basically.
That's my understanding. So
which is I've described Palm Springs.
The other thing is you were the first person to publicly declare J.J. Abrams sucks, and you were totally right. On our podcast,
I didn't think the first person.
You were one of the first because this podcast was like one of our first, right? So this was probably almost 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago. And at that point, he's writing kind of high off Force Awakens, which was pretty well received. And I don't believe Last Jedi had even come out yet. So there hadn't even been this oh, this is what it could have been. Thing that had kind of happened on Twitter. Last Jedi, you correctly identified J.J. Abrams would fuck this up.
You did.
Congratulations.
I had seen his other work, so it didn't seem like a, you know, a leap.
I know.
To me, I had sat through Lost. My opinions have not changed, and it was nice to see them validated, although I was very sad that the trilogy did not work out so great.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that, you know, it's kind of ironic, first of all, that we're talking about Star Wars during the Entrapment episode. But the second thing that I'll say is that, who cares? But I'll say this. When Colin Trevorrow was booted from the third movie, there was much rejoicing. Lots of people saying, like, thank God he's gone. And then JJ comes in to save us all from ourselves. And then the script leaks that Trevorrow wrote, and it is considerably better than what we got for the third movie. And we all should just basically say, maybe we weren't. Maybe we shouldn't have been jumping for joy that Colin Trevorrow was kicked off the third movie.
I think we were right to jump for joy. But...
Yeah, I don't think he's... him. JJ being lousy does not make Colin Trevorrow better.
Just to be clear, I'm not suggesting...
I think it is Trevorrow. I think it's like Tomorrow.
Trevorrow.
Okay, Tomorrow.
Here's Trevorrow. What I'll say is this. I'm not sitting here writing for Colin as a filmmaker necessarily, but the script that he was working from, that, or at least the one that has gotten out in the world, is considerably better than what we got for Rise of Skywalker.
Yes.
Now I'm not saying that it's a one-to-one situation here, but the script for Rise of Skywalker is such a steaming pile of shit that you're just sort of like, anyone working off of a better script might have made us a better movie. That's really kind of all I'm saying.
Well, yeah.
I do want to say one thing about scripts though. Sometimes you have a script that's totally competent.
Yes.
Like the script for, say, Entrapment.
Yeah.
That has been destroyed by every single directorial decision that was made. Like, I kept thinking, like, there's nothing about the structure, the mechanics, and the dynamic of this movie that had to be this fucking terrible. But almost every decision they made, from the casting to the score to the lighting to the locations to the casting of extras, was horrible.
I couldn't agree with you more, Kenny. It was one of those things where when it started, I thought to myself, oh, it's already bad. Like almost no joke from the title card of highlighting Trap in Entrapment that I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
It was not. I will say though, I don't think the script is that the script relies so heavily on exposition.
Exposition,
like,
it's true.
It's like that was its big problem, was that it tells you way too much and then they go do the thing. And then it tells you way too much again and then they go do the thing. And it's just unbalanced in terms of action versus exposition.
It could have been, all I'm saying is it could have been merely bad.
Yes.
And I am totally down with a merely bad, low expectation process movie, right? I've seen so many of them, and like, you know, it's every Fast and the Furious movie is, this is what we're gonna do, this is how we're gonna do it, and you just, I don't mind doing the whole shutting off my brain thing at all, but there's something like in order to be able to get away with that, you need style. You really need style. Yes. And all the Fast and the Furious movies, and you know, as much as some people hate Michael Bay, and I love Michael Bay, like there is a style to that that takes you from A to B to C. And this is, are they trying to do a high octane Hitchcock? Like, is that what's happening here?
Maybe. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way, but that might have been it feels, you know, the director, I think, had mostly done like British TV at that
point. I'm looking at his filmography right now.
And like it has that kind of soulless feel of a lot of mediocre British TV, where there's just, it's just people saying things. There's no directorial like take on anything. Yeah.
I'll say this. I'm gonna walk through five of this filmmaker's movies because it feels like this to me really kind of encapsulates him as a filmmaker. You've got Summersby in 93, the Richard Gere, Jodie Foster movie, where whatever. Kenny's favorite film, Copycat.
Yeah, I love Copycat.
Kenny loves Copycat.
Great flick.
He follows up Copycat with a comedy, The Man Who Knew Too Little, the Bill Murray movie.
Bill Murray movie.
Oh, okay.
Then he does this movie.
Actually trying to be like a Hitchcock spoof.
Right.
So I'm sure he went from that to saying, you know, I can do a real Hitchcock. I think I could do it. Give me any script, I'll turn it.
There is a little bit of
anything with an old ass man and a young woman, and
there's a
real like shitty Bond component to this too. It feels a little bit.
Yeah. It feels like a movie that was predicated on the idea that women all want to sleep with their really mean gymnastics coach. Because, like, 60% of the movie is him yelling at her.
Yeah, yeah. For not being that, for not being good enough at gymnastics.
For not being good enough at gymnastics. And I don't think that's a fantasy that women have.
I have to say, watching this and pairing it with Audition, which we just did, which we're doing after this, which also has a very ballet coach terrible relationship going on there.
Goes a little differently in that one.
Yeah, but just to wrap up on John, I believe it's John Emil. He does The Core in 2003, and then that kind of hits the skids for him, and he does basically just TV from that point on, because that was a very, very expensive movie flop.
But he does a lot of TV, and if you run down some of his, if you run down some of his credits,
yep.
Just like movies like, say, like The Core, for instance, or Summersby, there are a lot of movies that like have kind of good log lines,
yep.
And like seem kind of interesting,
yeah.
And then they're all bad. I think this guy's a bad filmmaker.
He's directed some decent TV. Like, he has had a later on, he's done some really good. He did a Halt and Catch Fire episode that's great.
Yeah,
like,
he did.
So maybe he got better.
I do. I also want his best film is Copycat when all he does is Copycat.
That one he really related to.
I'll say this. I think that it kind of folds back on what you were saying originally, Jessica, which is that he started in TV. You know what I mean? So it's like starts in TV, understands how to sort of and obviously directing TV, directing movies are two very different things, right? And I think he just kind of got swallowed a little bit by big budgets and by sort of bigger scope. And he's just better in a smaller, you know, smaller universe. But I mean, listen, this movie is just it's bad on a lot of levels. But I would say to your point, Kenny, on the direction, this movie is so deeply misogynistic. Like, it's such a shitty boy movie. Do you know what I mean? That's part of it too that kind of bothers me, where it just feels like the whole thing is kind of very much through the male gaze and the male sort of like perspective of things. Even just the way that Catherine Zeta-Jones is directed in this movie, there's only one woman in this film really, and it's her.
Yeah.
And she's just there to act like bratty teenager.
Yeah, she doesn't really have a character, and in fact, like, you can't figure out for a long time, and I still can't tell if this is intentional, if she's actually lying about being a thief or not. Like, she just suddenly is like, oh yeah, I'm a thief, and then starts doing gymnastics and climbing his walls, and you're like, What? There's no, like access point to understanding her character at all.
No, that's terrible. That's I think that is by design. I think that's what they were intending, unfortunately. She's a thief. Like, they do the Sean Connery, I'll explain the entire movie to you at the end. And he explains the movie, which is for some unspoken, unbelievable reason, she is a thief that is so important that that's who they are getting Sean Connery, a world famous thief, to turn on. Like, his deal with the feds was, all right, I'll bring in Catherine Zeta-Jones, this even better thief, I guess. So the whole thing, while teaching her to be an even better thief.
But she's been working at an insurance company for 5 years.
Big time front.
It's a long con. Long con. She's playing the long game.
But like, she's an incredibly wealthy and successful thief. Would you choose voluntarily to work at an insurance company for 5 years if you could choose?
Too long of a con.
Yeah, that's insane. Also, can we just talk about her boss for a minute? Why?
Hector Cruz?
Yeah, like, he he says at the beginning that he left the FBI several years ago, but then suddenly he shows up and, like, FBI agents are doing what he tells them. And I literally screamed at the TV, like, you're not an FBI agent anymore. Why are they listening? Why are you in charge of anything? And why would he give her a gun if his plan is to... Yeah, I just...
Yeah, no, I mean, the first thing I texted to Phil was, you know, Will Patton as Hector Cruz, we're going to be okay. So, something along those lines. I don't know how you go through the, you know, the three Latinx actors in Hollywood in 1999 and then say, oh, we'll go with a white man with a Southern accent and blonde hair for Hector Cruz. But that's what we went with. It's a bad. It's a terrible movie. The script is very bad. I was wrong.
I want to say one other thing though.
But it's also joyless, which I think is the problem.
It's deeply boring, which is terrible too. But the end of the movie, like on the train tracks, the final scene on the train tracks, feels like such a reshoot or a rewrite. Like it doesn't even feel a part of the movie. Like on some level, this idea, like this long sort of convoluted thing about Sean Connery trying to get her, feels like they were like, yeah, we can kind of jam this in, right? Like it'll just feel like a twist. It's completely unearned.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Also, it had led me to develop a counter theory about what the movie is actually about, which is not a movie about two thieves tricking each other. It is a movie about two magicians who have actual teleportation powers who try to pull off thieving heists without using their powers as like a challenge. And if you read it that way, because like they spontaneously teleport several times in the movie. And if you read it as that, it's a much more interesting film. They have something to fight against, which is their own, you know, immortal, you know, magician powers.
Your theory is also my theory, by the way. And it upset me very much at the end when Sean Connery teleports and then you realize that he actually just ran under the track and he comes up the stairs and he's out of breath. And I'm like, wait, you're telling me he wasn't teleporting? What is happening here? Like, because he does. He teleports out of her room. For God knows.
Yeah, he teleports.
How did he leave her room? There's no explanation. He could teleport. All right, so before we go any further on this movie, and I think this movie is one of the few that deserves a kind of a line-by-line breakdown. Jessica, you had an awful story relating to this movie, I heard a rumor about it.
So, all right, this is a vulnerable and intense story for me. So it's 1999 when this movie comes out, and I had started dating a guy a couple months before. And it was fairly casual, but like we'd meet in the back of Barnes and Noble and make out because that's nice. The kind of children we were. And but I had also met his best friend and fallen wildly in love with his best friend. And it was mutual. So I break up with the first guy. I'm like, this is not working out. I'm kind of into your best friend. And I invited the second guy to go see Entrapment with me. But like we were friends at this point and I wasn't being super clear that this was a date, but like. This was my move. I was going to take him to see Entrapment.
You were entrapping him.
Yeah, I was. I was entrapping him. So I get to the movie theater and guy I'm trying to date shows up with guy I just dumped because he misinterpreted the signal and was like, yeah, we're all going to hang out together as friends. This is super cool. So this is also, by the way, at the point at which I'm realizing I'm not 100% straight. So you've got like Catherine Zeta-Jones writhing around on screen in a cat suit, and that's making me very uncomfortable with myself. And I am sandwiched between a guy who did not realize we were going on a date and a guy I broke up with literally that week for the entire terrible movie. And that reason, I didn't even remember that there was a second heist in this movie. I retained no details past the first heist.
You somehow found a way to make Entrapment worse, which is impressive.
My great skill in movies and why I'm so successful.
Take any movie and make it worse.
Yeah, let's hire Jessica for our writer's room. She can ruin anything.
That's a horrible story. I'm sorry that happened to you, particularly when you were young and vulnerable. And also, it would have been a bad story if you had just seen Entrapment.
Yeah. That was not getting out of that day with a win.
Yeah. So Yeah, so this is really a terrible movie.
It's a terrible movie.
No redeeming qualities.
Well, wait, it has one. We know at all times how close we are to the millennium, and
that's something we do.
I feel like gets overlooked in a lot of movies.
That's not a you know, ephemeral point. Like, there are shockingly few movies that we've done that deal directly with the millennium. I'd say it's this and End of Days, and that's basically all I can think of that, you know, and it was so on the president of the culture at the time. Like that guy in the sandwich board saying the Y2K bug was developed by Satan. That was a real thing. I think people, you know, understand that people were deathly afraid of this Y2K bug. So I appreciate that there were movies that actually, you know, flew into that storm to some extent. But yes, the Chiron helped significantly.
Oh, all of them. We got down to hours to the millennium.
Yeah, minutes.
We really did. And it was meaningless to the story.
Completely
ultimately.
Had no point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like it was meaningless to the world. They predicted that one.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So I'm gonna give a brief synopsis of Entrapment for the people that haven't seen it. Insurance investigator Virginia Jin Baker, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones, looking into a stolen Rembrandt painting, suspects that accomplished thief Robert Mac McDougall. I love that they both have. Nicknames. Is responsible. She decides to go undercover and help Mac steal an ancient artifact. When a suspicious Mac confronts Jin about her real intentions, she claims that she is, in fact, a thief and that the insurance job is a cover. To prove it, she proposes a new target that could net them $8
billion.
That's not
how she proved it. She proved it by doing acrobatics.
Yeah. This movie was written by Academy Award winner Ron Bass and Academy Award nominee William Broyles of My Best Friend's Wedding and Castaway fame, individually, not together, directed by John Emile. It opened on April 30th, 1999, in first place with $6.9 million against Idle Hands. It would go on to make $211 million worldwide on a $66 million budget. That is shocking that this movie had repeat, like, people going back multiple times to see this fucking thing. Entrapment has 38% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 50% from audiences. I'm going to read a brief portion of Roger Ebert's 3 out of 4 star review of this movie. Entrapment is the very embodiment of a star vehicle, a movie with a preposterous plot, exotic locations, absurd action scenes, and so much chemistry between attractive actors we don't care. It stars Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones in a caper that reminded me of To Catch a Thief, Charade, or Top Cappy. And the stunt sequences in Bond pictures, I didn't believe it for a second, and I didn't care that I didn't. It works because it's made stylishly, because Connery and Zeta-Jones are enormously attractive actors, and because of the romantic tension between them. I got a letter the other day complaining that the age differences between the male and female leads is in several recent pictures. And to be sure, Connery is 69, Zeta-Jones is 29. Remember different wars. But the movie cannily establishes ground rules. Mac lectures that thievery is a business that permits no personal relationships. And so instead of questioning why they're erotically involved, we wish they would be. As for Zeta-Jones, I can only reflect, as I did while watching The Mask of Zorro, that while beautiful women are a dime a dozen in the movies, those with fire, flash, and humor are a good deal more scarce.
All right.
What the fuck is Roger Ebert?
Roger Ebert was high when he wrote that review.
First, before we unpack Roger Ebert, which I do want to, or rob his grave, raise him. I want to ask why you guys think this movie was such a success.
I think it was Catherine Zeta-Jones. She was coming off of Mask of Zorro. There was no one hotter in the business at that point. Like, she looked like nobody, you know, she didn't, she had a very unusual quality. She was very intriguing. And I think it, and you know, the movie promised us lots and lots of her ass. So I think that was it.
I think that's it too. I mean, look, I think Connery was a decent draw as well for a certain audience, old people. But I, we, you know, this is our second Catherine Zeta-Jones movie this year, The Haunting, which was a big flop. So Catherine Zeta-Jones in and of herself wasn't the draw. It was Catherine Zeta-Jones's ass going under a piece of yarn. That was the draw. And it's weird and bad and gross to say, but this is one of the few times I feel like they marketed the sex appeal of a young hot star and it worked. And it's kind of the exception, and I mean this in, you know, in a bad way. It's the exception that informs the rule. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, like, so rarely do they just put, like, one I remember very clearly was that movie The Big Bounce that had Foster, Sarah Foster in it.
Yeah.
And Sarah Foster was like just on the verge of having a moment. And Sarah Foster is obviously very gorgeous, and they put her in a bikini on. She overshadowed Owen Wilson on those posters, right? Just like Catherine Zeta-Jones is overshadowing, you know, Sean Connery, a far more established star. And it didn't work because the movie looked stupid and people aren't just going to go for a young, attractive, up-and-coming actress. But there is something about, to your point, Jessica, something about time, place, setting, and context that just did it for my dad and all the other dads.
I mean, it's also a classic male power fantasy of, you know, a 69-year-old guy being able to seduce the hottest woman in Hollywood. Yeah. That had to factor in.
I will say that, you know, when I was watching this film, I was thinking about a film that I know you didn't like, Kenny, which is The Thomas Crown Affair. And I thought about how if you cast the right people, basically what I thought is of Roger Ebert's review of like the delusional version he saw, which is that two stars that have crackling chemistry and that ultimately you can ride that all the way to the bank, right? I mean, if that's working, ultimately it doesn't really matter. Those lo-fi sort of high-techy kind of 70s heist movies that this movie's trying to kind of allude to, you can get away with that if you have a Romancing the Stone and Out of Sight, a Thomas Crown Affair. Like, if you have those pairs of people that really fucking work together. And this movie, to me, and I'm assuming you guys feel the same way, they are so bad together in this movie that you're left with just this badly directed, soggy, slow, plodding movie and this creepy, weird, almost father-daughter, but we're supposed to think
big
they want to fuck
energy. Father and daughter. He calls this good girl all the time.
It's
That's what
really,
I call my daughter, that good
it's
girl.
It's really creepy. It's like the director had never met a woman in his entire life. Like, the odd thing is that if you're going to sexualize Catherine Zeta-Jones, like, there are ways to do it considerably better. They give her the ugliest fancy dress of all time. Like, I have never, the dress she wears to the ball that they make a big deal about is the ugliest goddamn thing ever. They don't know how to shoot her right. Like, And just she just randomly sleeps naked all the time. It's like a 12-year-old's idea of how to make an adult woman sexy, and it infantilizes her, which makes it even worse.
To your point, he's never spoken to an adult woman or seen an adult woman, I would say, outside of the context of barely legal pornography, because that's how it felt. Right. Like, it felt like it just the whole thing had that, like, for instance, your point about her sleeping naked all the time. She doesn't cover herself up when a stranger is in her room. I mean, he's not a stranger. She knows who it is. But like, he's a stranger. Right. She's never interacted with this person. Like, people cover themselves up when anybody walks into the room, you know, like anybody outside of like your significant other. It's absurd that she wouldn't think to do that.
There's also, as I was doing, there's a little bit of reading to be done about this movie, not much on the internet. But one of the things apparently is that Catherine Zeta-Jones was actually fully nude in the bed when they were shooting the scene.
Of course,
which I'm just like, okay. I don't understand the context of that. I don't understand. We've all been on movie sets. There's absolutely no reason for her to be completely naked. There's no reason for it whatsoever. So if the director asked for it, that's fucked up. And if she did it on her own, it's also fucked up. Like, all of it's just weird. And it adds to this energy you're talking about, Kenny, which is that the way it's shot to show you that she's naked without showing you everything, which is almost somehow creepier in some weird way that I can't, it's all very strange.
Yeah. Well, and the weird thing, they try to give her their version of agency, which is making her the active seducer in the situation. But it's like, why in God's name would she be trying to seduce a 70-year-old man? Like, that's not in any way. And why would a 70-year-old man be like so adamant about rejecting her? That it doesn't, it totally fails. Like, it's the exact wrong way to go.
It's interesting. You were talking about agency, Jessica, which I fully agree with. And the script is so lopsided in the sense that, so Mac is supposed to be, or theoretically is this master thief. And we barely see him do anything in this movie. The whole movie is her explaining what she's then going to go do.
Yeah.
And he like wags his finger at her from time to time and says, it's not possible. It's not possible. And then she goes and does it.
But it doesn't do anything.
It's fucking crazy. Like, I was thinking to myself, as I don't remember which heist she's explaining to him, but at some point you're just like, he doesn't even need to be in this movie. Like, he serves basically no purpose.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, when they get to like the final computer room and he's just there bitching about computers and how banks are and how there's not bars of gold, like he's from 1860. Like, it's just like, why are you here? This could just be a movie about a woman thief. You could have died in the first act, and that would be how this movie was made now, is that he's her mentor who gets killed for motivational reasons. Yep. She's just keeping grandpa around Europe for some reason.
Yeah. To that point, on that tip to some extent, like, the movie almost gives her too much agency. Like, it's almost too intent on making it her movie. That what I'm trying to say is, he doesn't need to be here, which you've already said, but it almost seems like this movie exists to put Sean Connery in as many shots as they can without having him do anything. Yes. Like, it seems like it was engineered to have him on screen as much as possible.
It felt almost as though they had to shoot him out or got as much footage as they could with him being as inactive as is humanly possible to slot into the film later. Like, even just like the scenes he has with Ving Rhames, who feels like he's playing the same role from the Mission Impossible movies, which is also, you know, sort of what it is. But it's just, he also doesn't have, I mean, Connery is just too old for this, right? He doesn't have the framework. He doesn't have the physique for it anymore. So,
which,
like,
Ving Rhames says, even in a lot you're of too old for shots. This shit. And I'm like, yes, you're right. You're right. He is too old. I also, I deeply despise the trope in a movie when two characters are in on a plan and speak around it when no one else is there.
Yeah.
It's infuriating to me. It's so insulting to the viewer. It's such trash. And I throw it out immediately when that kind of shit happens. This movie is much worse than Thomas Crown Affair, which is so bad. Like, this movie can't even walk into the setting, the museum in which Thomas Crown steals priceless pieces of art. It makes me think the art heist movie is maybe too hard.
I don't know if that's true. I don't know that this movie even really is trying. Like, I don't get the impression that anybody was really putting in the work or the time to make it good. Like, it just felt like everyone's going through the motions.
Has there been a really good art heist movie
recently?
Let's look. Let's see. It's a good question.
Because you think it would be easy because they're, you know, the whole notion of the gentleman thief, which is very attractive. And there is also the idea of, like, as opposed to stealing money or drugs, the unloading of the art is interesting to me too. Turning art into money is interesting to me. And stealing from a museum as opposed to a bank, things that are kind of in plain sight. Like, there's a lot there to me, but I can't remember a particularly good art heist movie unless, you know, you think Thomas Crown is good, which it's not. So,
but it actually is. So there's that.
It's so bad. It's so
but it is. Right. But I'll say this. I think that I agree with everything you're saying, Kenny, which is that it's all there for the taking. It doesn't feel like anyone's fully cracked it. I'll give you that the Thomas Crown Affair, you know, is perhaps the best of the bunch, and it's not the greatest movie that's ever been made. Like, there is something that needs to be done with this that hasn't been done yet. I guess there's a part of me that wonders, and we've had this conversation on this podcast before, but, like, movies that feel like they're made by committee, you know, or by a studio that's just like, yeah, we've got Sean Connery, we've got this heist script, we've got this pretty competent director, we've got this hot up-and-coming young actress. Like, it's all there, right? Like, this, and the problem is it made over $200 million worldwide, so they weren't wrong.
No, they weren't wrong. It's bad. It's bad when shit like this happens. It's bad when Jurassic World makes $1 billion and people think Colin Trevorrow gets to make what he wants after that. No offense to Colin Trevorrow. Seems like a very lovely man. Gets very upset when people talk bad about him on podcasts. But
what were you going to say, Jessica?
What the movie reads like to me is that I think they knew they didn't have a great script or a great director, but when they went out to stars, they wrote it. They told Sean Connery, oh, don't worry, this is going to make you look like a big spy star again. You're going to be in, you know, all these scenes that you have nothing to do in. Like, it's going to be great. And they went to Katherine Johnson and were like, oh, don't worry, you're going to be playing a character with all sorts of agency and who's really competent and good at her job and who's great. And, like, and then they just wrote a bunch of that shit in and it doesn't really connect to anything or have anything to do with the core of the story. Like, mm-hmm. This feels like it got a vanity right in both directions for the stars. And as such, like, it's like three movies.
All right, we'll be back with the podcast in a couple of minutes, but first, a word from our sponsor. That's right, we got a sponsor. Folks, do you love movies? The good ones? Even the bad ones everyone told you not to like? It sounds like Super Yaki is the place for you. The team at Super Yaki loves movies so much that they decided to dedicate every waking moment of their lives to bringing you top-quality merchandise to showcase your love for them.
From super soft t-shirts rightfully demanding a production of a third national treasure to comfy sweatshirts that reasonably serve as a call to arms for all those in support of making Judy Greer America's lead. They even have pins of some of your favorite directors like Sofia Coppola and Jordan Peele. Super Yaki joyously brings your tangible love letters to movies and filmmakers that you can wear with pride.
Plus, the team at Super Yaki screen prints all their apparel using eco-friendly 100% water-based inks and ships with compostable poly mailers for an environmentally friendly alternative to online shopping.
And as a special gift to you, listeners can save 10% on their order with the code SUPERFRIEND. All caps, no spaces. That's SUPERFRIEND at checkout. And if the spirit moves you, find them at superyaki.com. Let's watch more movies. That's Super Yaki, SUPERYAKI.com. Thanks for listening to that ad, guys. Now back to the show.
Let's ask the $1 million question.
Yeah. So, Jessica, yes. Question for you. Kenny and I have been texting about this, or we're texting about this during our rewatch of Entrapment. Is Catherine Zeta-Jones a bad actor? Have we been hoodwinked? Did she win an Oscar somehow in a way that doesn't make any sense?
What did she win an Oscar sense. For? Chicago?
But I want to hear the answer.
I don't know. It's very hard Chicago. To tell with actors. Yeah, it's very hard to tell with actresses whether they are bad or whether they are not being given good material or material that they particularly are good at. And she's one of those ones that's kind of right on the bubble. Like, maybe she's not great and maybe she's not her strengths are not being played to. There are some actors out there who I think are not great actors who have incredibly successful careers because they know how to choose roles or they're offered roles that play to their strengths. And I think because she was so like gorgeous and unusual in Hollywood when she got really hot, like people just cast her based on that. And that may not actually be what she's good at, but I don't know what she is good at.
I'll say this, and I agree with you, because I do think that she's good in Mask of Zorro. Like, it's understandable why Mask of Zorro gets her, you know, on the radar. And then she's in this, and then she's in The Haunting, and they're both obviously the 99 movies.
And they're terrible movies.
They're both terrible movies, and they're both terribly directed.
And she's so terrible in them, though. She is the worst part in both of those movies.
Agreed.
I think Connery is worse in this one, honestly.
I don't think she can like deliver a line in this.
I really honestly don't think she can either. I agree with you, Kenny. Every line she delivers in this movie, it's like she's and this is why I think to your point, we should not be too hard on her necessarily. But to your point, Jessica, an actor not being given a life raft, like just being said to like walk the tightrope without any sort of net and just go with your instincts at this stage in her career is unfair. Because I just don't think that she has the wherewithal to know to understand the material, to understand the tone.
I'm sure she's good. She's 29 years old. Like I almost think that's unfair. Like we've seen so many 29-year-old actors and actresses at this point in their career have so much success in different genres, with different directors. I'm going to keep riding this Catherine Zeta-Jones is no good train. You guys both think she was good in Mask of Zorro, which, you know, I haven't seen in 23 years. But just going through her filmography, you have this movie she's not good in. You have The Haunting she's not good in. You have High Fidelity I didn't particularly like her in. Traffic she's not good in. America's Sweethearts is a disaster. Chicago I want to put a pin in. Intolerable Cruelty. Did you guys like that or not?
No.
No, okay, it's
but
bad.
Hold on. I want to defend this.
Ocean's 12 also bad.
Yes, I want to defend both of those performances a little bit. I agree with everything else you're saying. And High Fidelity was a big one that I forgot about that she is really not good in. But I don't think she's terrible in Intolerable Cruelty. I don't like that movie particularly. I think it's obviously a lesser Coen Brothers movie. But I actually think she's got pretty good chemistry with Clooney, for what it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, she does. I don't think it's her. I think that one's the movie. But again, I'm looking at this list of movies and like, what does she have to do in most of those? They're not. I think she may be bad at choosing roles, or her reps are bad at bringing her stuff.
Or she's not getting offered stuff, which is also another thing, too.
Yeah.
I mean, Kenny, I think this feels like the good time to talk about Chicago, because I do think she's good in it, but I think you have thoughts on the idea of someone winning an Oscar for a musical.
I have two thoughts. One is Catherine Zeta-Jones can sing and she can dance. And to have someone who looks as uniquely gorgeous as she does, who also is in possession of those two talents, is like a unicorn. So that's one thing.
Yes.
So that is her lane. Two, like, winning an Oscar for a musical is different. It's a different thing. Like, Joel Grey won an Oscar, and I don't think Joel Grey had one spoken line of dialogue in Cabaret. So it's a different and taking nothing away from the performance. And if it's on film, like, yeah, you're totally in the game, and I get it. But I wouldn't translate an Oscar win for a musical, particularly a Fosse musical, but a musical like that that's so about performance in a, you know, theatrical sense, and translate that to her abilities as an actor in any other context. And it's not like we're seeing, it's not like, for instance, Joel Grey has gone on to do a lot of other material. Jennifer Hudson has gone on to do a lot of other material. Like, that's just not their lane. They're musical actors. And I think that's really where Catherine Zeta-Jones' strengths lie. So,
yeah, I mean, did you guys see Rock of Ages?
No. Yeah, I did, and she was terrible. But not her fault.
I mean, it's
the world's worst character, so I can't blame her.
It's a bad movie. But I agree with you in the sense, Kenny, that I think that her when she can kind of go big, like go theatrical, which she does obviously in Chicago and in Rock of Ages, she just seems a lot more comfortable. It's when she has to like act like a real human being that she has trouble.
She's also one of these actors who's fallen into like a lane where they can never use their actual speaking voice.
Voice, yeah.
Which, you know, I wouldn't mind hearing a Welsh accent here and there.
Yeah.
God, that's true. She has an accent. That's interesting. Yeah, you totally forget about that. But she does have a slightly stilted way of speaking, and that's probably why she's always in a different accent.
And, I mean, she's also playing Latinx characters as well, despite having no Latino heritage. Yep. But that's another accent she's finding herself in a lot. That is not her natural accent. I mean, this came up a little bit, but I'm a Cheerleader, though it's not the same at all. But like hearing Melanie Lynskey talking her in her, you know, natural accent like that and Heavenly Creatures, it's different. It's different. And this is not an argument against having people play characters of their same race with different accents. Obviously there's so many actors who can do that, do it well. But some people like Melanie Lynskey or Catherine Zeta-Jones fall into this pattern where they're constantly playing actors. Matthew Reese is another one, constantly playing actors who are not of their same ethnicity their same nationality.
Yeah, I mean, it is strange that she is put in that box. And I will say that the accent is I certainly felt the accent issues in this film, a little less so in The Haunting, weirdly, because I just thought The Haunting was just such a mess in so many ways that I was almost
I didn't notice in The Haunting.
But this one, she really felt like she not had a mouthful of marbles, but just that, like, I don't know, that, like, someone else's voice was coming out of her face. I don't know how to explain it.
It was at one point in the scene in her bedroom. Yeah. The ADR is so fucking terrible. It's like they forgot to record room tone for one of them.
It's incredible. I also just want to say that I found a piece of trivia that I love, which is that Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones's kiss or quote unquote love scene was voted the second worst of all time by readers of Film Magazine in 2003. Narrowly
beaten
before you say it,
Jessica, have any guesses? Okay.
What was the year?
Well, the this is of all time. The year that this was compiled was 2003.
Okay, well, I'm telling you, what it should be is Pretty in Pink, because I watched that again, and the kiss between Molly Ringwald and Andrew McCarthy at the end is the most disgusting kissing scene I have ever... Like, I was physically revulsed and horrified by it, but I doubt that's actually it, because I don't think most people realize it. What is it, though? I need to know.
I also have a bad nominee.
Go. Yeah,
the worst kiss in movie history is, unfortunately, is in the best film. In the end of Kindergarten Cop, when Arnold Schwarzenegger and Penelope Ann Miller have their reunion kiss, Arnie literally looks like he is about to like predator her head off.
Oh my God.
But everything else about that movie is perfect. So, you know, 99 for me, but it's the worst kiss you'll ever.
That's fantastic. The love scene that was voted the worst of all time was Sharon Stone and Joe Pesci in Casino.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, I sit there.
It's a bad one.
Can't argue.
That's a rough one. But I mean, I will say, though, it really speaks volumes to the fact that they don't really have a love scene in this movie. Like, they kiss briefly, and it's terrible, right, and it's awful. Ugh. But it goes to show how bad people felt about it, that it ranks this high.
Except Roger Ebert.
Because there are worse sex scenes, I think. Like, actual sex scenes. Yeah,
there are worse sex scenes. We gave our worst ones, Phil. What you got?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's worse sex scenes than Sharon Stone and Joe Pesci in Casino. I'm trying to think of bad kisses. It's I don't have anything off the top of my head. I'm going to have to think about this. I'll have something by the end of the episode, but nothing's coming to me right off the top of my head. The other thing that I thought was interesting was that Anton Fuqua was originally attached to direct this, and he definitely would have made a better movie.
Yeah. Yeah, by far.
Yeah. So let's just walk through the plot of this disaster. We both mentioned that.
Did he do a 99 movie real fast?
I believe he did. He do the Corruptor or the what is it called?
There's a movie called The Corruptor in 1999. That is true.
Isn't that the movie with Mark Wahlberg and what's his face? I think he directed that. Hold on, I'm looking it up. I'm pretty sure he did. Sorry, guys, bear with me. No, James Foley directed that. My apologies. I don't think Fuqua had a 99 movie.
No, yeah. we could do his pros video if you want. Training Day was 2 years later. Replacement Killers was the year before.
Oh, that's what I was mistaking. I got it mixed up with the replace because that also had Chow Yun Fat.
Yeah,
of Anne and the King fame.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my favorites.
Oh God, I love that you came off Anne and the King, Jessica. It really warms my heart. I just want to say that.
You know, when I was 16, or I thought it was a wonderful movie about another culture, and you know,
half of that is right.
Time has passed.
It is about another culture.
It certainly is.
So this film opens, as any good film does, by a title card that highlights the word within the word, which is trap. Just in case, you know, you guys were unclear as to what this film was going to be about. It opens with like this generic, shitty night cityscape photography, night vision, shitty Bond, Mission Impossible heist of someone stealing a painting from inside a... I guess it's an office or a house in a skyscraper or something like that, right?
Yeah, it's an office. I think it's an office.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And then we're immediately reminded, as Jessica said to us earlier, that the millennium is coming, and that's gonna play an important part in this film. But just kidding, it's not really going. It's just the thing. We then meet Virginia Jin Baker. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
It's a very, very uninspiring opening heist. Like,
it's real boring.
It's like Blue Streak starts with a heist, and Blue Streak is a Martin Lawrence comedy, and the heist is so much more interesting than this.
10 movie. Times better than this. 100%.
100 times better than this heist, where the only thing of interest that happens is she repels down the side. We don't even know who's in the cat suit, but she repels down the side of a building, which you've seen. And then once she gets in there, it's over. There's nothing that happens.
Like, it's hard to call it a heist. It's kind of just, I mean, like someone breaking into your house and stealing something is not a heist. That's just theft. Like, heist requires extensive planning and complicated scheming. She just gets into a building through the window and then takes a painting.
I've seen
depictions this is just
of,
somebody. This is.
I've seen depictions of Watergate that are more interesting.
Yes. Yeah. I would watch Blue Streak 20 times again before this.
Blue Streak is good. I mean,
Blue Streak's a good movie.
We then meet Virginia Jin Baker, Catherine Zeta-Jones, at her office with her skeezy boss, who's just like laying it on so thick and flirting with her so hard it's disgusting. But what I don't know if you guys noticed this, but so she's working as an investigator at some fucking insurance place. It doesn't matter. But they shoot this scene and then it feels like there's a cut to something else and we come back and it's now nighttime and it's like the same setup. It's literally like they left the camera in place. They changed the lighting and they're like, it's nighttime now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. But anyway, I love that we're supposed to believe Sean Connery has hair in this movie. I think it's fantastic that he's got like that. They're trying to pull like an Elton John situation where it's just like, yeah, he's got hair now. And you're like, but he hasn't had hair for like 20 years. But anyway.
Yeah, it's Bruce Willis. Yeah. Bruce will also show up with hair in Sixth Sense, and you're just like, I don't know if that makes the movie better. I don't know if that's a good thing.
You always wonder, is it the actor requiring that, or is it the film? Like, that's always my question. Who is insistent upon this point?
It's a great question. It's a weird conversation to have.
Yeah.
How do you go to Connery and say, look, in this movie, we really think you should have hair? Yeah. Like, I think this character would not have succumbed to male pattern baldness. He would have had every attribute you have physically, except he would have used Rogaine in his mid-30s. That's the one thing I know about this. That's the character. One thing.
So there's this amazing moment. I don't know if you guys noticed it, where Jin is stalking the Kryptonic building. I don't know why the fuck that. Anyway, and she's
that's
over my head. That one.
That's like out of the Dennis Rodman movie.
That's out of Simon Says for sure.
Out of Simon Says, yeah. That's just some like leftover signage from Simon Says.
So she's staking out the Kryptonic building to see if she can find Mac. And she takes a sip from her iced coffee and puts it on the dash. And then they show the passage of time by the iced coffee going down. Did you notice this?
How could you not notice that?
I didn't, because at that point I had already stopped keeping my eyes on the screen for most of the film.
Went straight to the second screen.
I gave it like 8 minutes and decided that was enough to judge the movie.
I have a like a gag reflex revulsion by looking at milk or milk-like products on glass or other translucent substances, or not translucent, other transparent substances. So there is something particularly revolting to me about a 5-6 finished iced latte sitting on a dashboard where there's
cooking
definitely
in the sun.
definitely a ring on that dashboard. Put it in a cup holder, for Christ's sakes. That's disgusting. And then she also eats something which just looks like it looks like a piece of bib lettuce. And then she just picked up a head of iceberg and is just chowing down.
I love that this scene tapped into all of your food issues. It's fantastic.
Oh, let's stop talking about the movie and just break down this coffee versus this milk aversion thing. This is what I want to know about.
I got these things, right? I don't know really how to explain it, but like I have all these.
It's called
like
obsessive
issues.
Compulsive disorder.
I'm that's true. I am OCD in real life. And one of my things is just like there's something about creamy substances, particularly like liquidy, viscousy, creamy substances on
this is plastic. So that Freudian,
makes me,
man.
Makes
this
me. Is... Yeah, you're right. But this happened before I even knew what semen was. This goes back to like I hesitate to think what happened to me in the developmental stages that made it.
This is amazing. Yeah, I love this.
It's super gross to me. And now the fact that you just pointed out how clear it is where this comes from really is making me question everything that's happened in my life.
Who knew that entrapment?
No, for sure. This isn't the only reason, but this is a big one.
This may have bumped the movie up a few points. This revelation. So it was during the podcast where about entrapment, where Jessica said she realized she wasn't 100% straight. Where I realized I wasn't 100% straight. That's happening.
I'm the fairy of bisexualism.
That is happening a lot in these podcasts lately. Where
that's
I'm like,
fantastic.
Am I 100% right anymore? Well, let's keep going. While I cruise the net.
We're gonna keep going. At this point in the film, Max sneaks into her bedroom in the middle of the night, or teleports, my apologies, into her room, and she tries to entrap him with a proposition claiming that she's a professional thief and that she can help him steal a priceless Chinese mask from the well-guarded Bedford Palace. Then he tells her some fucking stupid rules like, I don't know, never carry a gun. You carry a gun, you may be tempted to use it or some nonsense.
It's a pretty good rule. But I like
he
that.
He does have
also
a line in
this. Never matters. Never matters.
Never,
in
never,
movie.
Never matters.
That's but more of a, that's more of a general gun control rule. I think he was just espousing at that point. It's just, this is why you don't keep a gun in your house, for instance. Yeah.
Make sure it's unloaded. Yeah.
He has a great line in this scene, though, where she says, he tells her to meet her outside the hotel at 9 a.m. And she's like, how do I know you'll be there? And he says, I'm never late. If I'm late, I'm dead.
Yeah, but the setup for that line is so stupid. Meet me outside the hotel. Yeah. How do I know you'll be there? Like, big fucking deal if he's not. Like, what I mean,
he just told you that he'd be there. Like he proposed it.
I like, what have you lost? Like, I don't even get you. Like, that is some like shit that sounds like it would happen in this movie, but doesn't make any sense in the context and just exists to set up the line that Phil, you were totally blinded by. You're like, forget setup. That line's too funny.
No, I agree. I got blinded by it. I liked the payoff enough that I didn't care about the setup.
It's true. You like the payoff.
So they travel to Scotland to plan a very complicated theft at Mac's hideout in an isolated castle. They then have an exchange.
I'm sorry, what was that? You just said Max what in a what?
Mac has a hideout in an isolated castle.
Right. He has a hideout in an isolated castle in Scotland.
In Scotland. And then they walk into her bedroom. She puts down her bag and he says, good night then. And she says, but it's early. And he says, we have an early start. And she says, but I'm not tired.
That's how you seduce people. That's how I seduce people. I try to act as much like an 8-year-old girl as possible. It works every time.
And I try to act like Michael Caine in Cider House Rules. That's my move.
Oh,
so,
oh my god!
Wow, that's dark.
Is it? That's what he's like. But Michael Caine is the best known. Michael Caine in Cider House Rules is the best known old man character who puts young people to bed.
This is true. He does. You're absolutely right. He does put people to bed a lot in that movie.
Not because he did that. Because he does abortions. Guys.
Abortions. He does say goodnight, you kings of Maine, you princes of New England or whatever.
Jeez, God, your minds are in the gutter all the time.
My apologies.
Telling you about
the
milk.
The skills section on his nanny CV is extremely strange. It's like good at putting children to sleep and performing abortions.
Kind of a double-edged sword.
This is the future liberals want.
We'll shut your child up no matter what.
Well, that is the future.
That's amazing. Right. So then Jin admits that she stole the Rembrandt by leaping off of the second floor balcony to show that she can do gymnastics.
She scaled a straight up and down wall to get up there because they show her on the ground and then they show her 30 feet up in the air where there's like a beam.
She's revealing her teleportation power. Correct, yeah. He revealed his in her room, and now to prove it, she is also showing that she can teleport.
And there's this like running theme to the movie. So basically she does like a series of ballet-inspired capoeira up there. I'm not really sure what she's doing, but I think you get the gist if I say that. And she does a flip onto a table and ends it by saying, perfect. And there's this... There's this theme running through where it's like she's perfect, I think, is the theme, but the text of the movie is how not perfect she is. Like she literally can't count to five at one point. He's like, remember when they're doing the bongs and she forgets the fifth bong? She's like, I forgot. But this is pre-cell phone, like pre-smartphone. I don't know how anyone would forget anything before you had a smartphone.
My favorite ridiculous part in that training sequence is when they're putting up the red thread for her to train with, and he's like shouting at her to make it really tight while she's pulling it over to another beam to tie it to, and it's like, there's no reason for her to make the thread tight until she gets to the other beam. And he's just yelling at her, that she's allowing yep. slack yeah. in the thread, which does yep. not matter. And it goes yep. on for a while. It so clearly feels like, oh, they just told him to improv being mean to her, and he picked the stupidest yeah. thing to complain about.
Yep. And then she's finally able to do it, but she forgets some part at the end of it, and he scolds her for that. And she's like, why do you have to be so mean to me?
And she's right, by the way. Like, yeah, the part that she yeah. forgot was she wasn't, as we'll soon learn, sorry to give away the end of it, she didn't have gum in her mouth, because that's the special activation device.
Or a monkey mask.
Yo, I hated the monkey mask so much.
Where the hell did she keep that?
Why is that necessary? Like, why would you call attention to that? How stupid is that?
It makes no fucking sense. It makes no sense.
This is an Ocean's 8. This is the easiest fucking thing. Go find someone who can make you a replica of that mask. Like, it's obvious. If you're gonna smuggle something in, get Mindy Kaling, have her mommy make you a replica. It's easy.
Yep. Yep.
It's also yep. really weird that they establish when the Rembrandt is stolen that the thief, whoever steals it thing, is putting up pictures of Elvis whenever they steal something, and then they don't do that with the mask.
It's like out of Home Alone. They're the Wet Bandits. They're the Elvis Bandits. The Blue Bandits.
They are the Wet Bandits.
Which, like, by even in Home Alone, the moral of Home Alone is like, don't have a signature when you're a thief, because then they'll know every house you hit on the block.
Yep,
that is true. That is the only message of Home Alone.
So then Aaron. Thibodeau shows up. They have a scene, whatever. But then we have Mac and Jin doing what I could honestly say is one of the most boring training sequences I've ever seen. Of them doing the training for the bongs or the you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, blowing up the floor tile thing that they need to get
right,
in.
Right, exactly. To the
12 chimes of the, when a clock strikes midnight.
Yeah.
but he even gives her shit because their stupid fucking crash pad thing that is going to catch their block of granite that they cut out doesn't inflate fast enough. This is supposed to be a second. You're supposed to take one second to inflate. Like, then you figure it out. You're the one who came up with this stupid crash pad.
Again, I am banking on that all being improv. Like, I think there was a training montage with no dialogue, and then they got there and were like, hey, Sean, just say something.
world famous improver, Sean Connery.
Sean Connery.
Well, it certainly fits.
Do your magic. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question, Kenny? Because we both like The Rock. I don't know how you feel about The Rock, Jessica. Are you a fan of The Rock?
Yeah, I like The Rock.
I think I'm probably with you. I like The Rock. I know that Kenny loves The Rock.
I think it's the best action movie ever made.
It's. Okay. I mean, listen. It's. that was the best okay I've ever heard.
I will accept no okays.
But
sarcastic or otherwise,
the reason I bring it up is because Sean Connery, for all intents and purposes, he has a lot more action in, or it certainly seems like he does a lot more action in The Rock than he does in this. Obviously, like physical, actual action, the character actually does things. But don't you feel as though it has, like, this is the shittiest version of his character from The Rock?
No.
Yeah.
No offense. No? I think this just sucks. Like, I think that
it has a similar dynamic of like the guy who's like, I've done this before and I'm the master and you're the apprentice sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess you're right that there is a lot of shared DNA there. Like, what it felt like to me was, right, the Rock was 95. This was 99. 4 years. He is physical on The Rock, right? He is rolling around. He is running. Yep. He is fighting. He is throwing a convincing punch. Like, he's physical in that movie. And he's 65? He's almost 70 in this movie. So he's 65 years old in that movie. And it just kind of struck me how much goes between 65 and 69. Like, he looks like a frail man in this movie.
Whereas in that movie, like, he comes out of the jail with his long hair, his full beard, and he looks like he could break anybody's neck in that room. So, I don't know.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm looking at his filmography right now. I agree with you, Kenny. It's interesting that – so The Rock is 96, and
– 96.
The Rock was a big fucking movie. I remember The Rock being a big deal. You know what I mean? People really loved that movie, understandably so. And he does not really capitalize on that. The next movie he does is that Avengers movie with Ralph Fiennes and Uma Thurman, where he plays the villain. And, you know, and then Entrapment's in 99. So there's a part of me that
a big movie, though.
It was. But he's not really doing much action in it. But my point is that, like, he could have come off The Rock and he probably could have banged out a couple, you know, shitty action movies, and people would have been on board for it, and he didn't. And I'm just sort of wondering why.
He could have done a little Liam Neeson. Run,
yeah,
right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it's hard. Like, anyway, those movies are hard to make well. Like, and you see it from the Liam Neeson movies. I mean, you know, I think he's made probably 10 of them now, and maybe like 3 of them are not the worst. So.
Yep. Yeah. So then we get to the heist of the Chinese mask. We can all agree Jin's dress is hideous.
So they're bad. Also,
did you notice that they shot Connery with like a soft lens for a little bit of that scene when she was coming down the stairs?
Yeah.
Then Jin's wearing a truly stupid masquerade mask at that.
And
at
he's that. Not wearing one at anything. All. This is the worst masked ball I've ever seen. Hers is see-through and he is not wearing one. Great disguise, guys.
Good work, guys. I thought the underwater heist stuff, and I have to admit I kind of liked the lo-fi hiding the explosions and the sound of the clock. Like, that to me was like,
I thought that was a highlight of this movie.
I admit that. Yeah.
It's fine.
I enjoyed that.
it's not like inspired, but it's fine.
For this movie, it is.
Yes, it is. It is better put together than the rest of the plot.
Or the movie, period.
Yeah.
So then they steal the mask, and Mac accuses Jin of planning to sell the mask to a buyer.
Is this when he drowns her 4 times?
Yeah, it's fucking crazy. Yeah.
Yes.
It's horrible.
Yeah. It's horrible.
Horrifying. Yeah. It's truly like
she also
truly
does not
horrifying.
Try to swim away when he's trying to drown her, because she is in the water and he is holding her down, and she makes no move to swim in the other direction. She lets him drown her.
It just feels like agree. This movie wouldn't have been that hard to make better. I have no concept at this point or at any point in the entire movie what their actual relationship to each other is in terms of the way they feel about the other one. Like, I get that, like, to some extent we're supposed to feel like, you know, and I say this with several grains of salt, two attractive people who are attracted to each other. But I don't really get the gamesmanship of it, right? Like, it's because of what you said in the beginning, Jessica, the idea of we have no entry point to understand what her character is thinking. But I don't even get it in the final analysis, like who's playing who at what point and for what purpose.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, it's very murky.
I also, the moment that really highlights exactly what you're talking about, Kenny, is the moment, and I don't obviously give a shit about spoiling it, it's the moment at the end when he gives her the parachute. And she's like, but will I ever see you again? And I'm just like, what? Like, I don't care about either of you. I have no understanding of your relationship. Is she into him sexually, or is he like a father figure, a mentor? I don't understand it. And I don't for a second believe that she actually cares if she sees this guy again.
Agreed.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually, everything up until the last thing, like,
yeah,
she's a baby in this movie, right? She's a little baby, and he's her like dad or grandfather, and that is what they've established, like, over the course of the movie, that like she is a baby and she needs her dad. So, like, I do get why, or at least I feel something to the effect of, like, at every point of this movie when she's been like lost on her own plan, she's gone to her daddy for help, and he's basically said, you know, tighten the string, But aside from that, I know this is a movie about an old dead man and a little baby trying to steal from the largest building in Southeast Asia.
By the way, that's a better movie.
Give it to Maury Chaykin, by the way, and like Maury Chaykin, Maury Chaykin was on Entourage, and Maury Chaykin is like a nice guy and a good actor. But Maury Chaykin is the guy who's supposed to play Harvey Weinstein on Entourage. Like, if you put him in a major movie in this role, it's because, like, I wrote a list because I wanted to really get this joke in, guys. It's because Dustin Hoffman, James Caan, Elliot Gould, Albert Brooks, Mandy Patinkin, Sal Rubinick, and John Polito said no.
Wait, is he the drug dealer, the weird villain guy in Kuala Lumpur? That was an interesting choice with everything that happens.
Every choice in that character, in that performance, is a choice.
Yes
it is. So is the makeup.
Yeah.
Heavy on the eyeliner.
So Mac is drowning Jin, and then she somehow gets a knife and gets the jump on him, but doesn't really threaten him with it, because literally about a second later, she just gives him the knife.
That's what you do with guys that try to drown you. You know, you want to establish trust again after that, so you hand them a weapon.
Yeah. Yep. That's how it works. So then Jin convinces him that her insurance company is the real cover, and that she has planned an even bigger heist of $8 billion from the quote unquote International Clearance Bank in Malaysia in the North Tower of the Petronas Towers. And then they kiss. They have that terrible kiss.
She's sleeping naked again for no reason.
Yeah. And he covers her up like a dad does, but then kisses her like a dad does. And then she opens her eyes, and I knew she was going to open her eyes, and I wanted to see what sort of emotion she tried to convey when she opened her eyes. And there's none. Like, you have no idea what you're supposed to be feeling in that moment. Fucking ridiculous. It's fucking movie.
I have no idea what I'm supposed to be feeling in this moment.
So during the setup, Cruz and his team, with the guidance of fucking Bing Rames, track down Jin, confirm that she is on a mission to bring Mac in. And now we have like the I guess essentially like the big heist of the movie, or the big action set piece of the film. And something that bothered me, and I don't know if you guys clocked it, is when they use the infrared lighting to see the fingerprints on the security keypad, but you wouldn't know what order those buttons were pressed in.
I hate that. I'm totally with you.
Well, I thought they knew because the weird, creepy art dealer guy gave her the password and said the thing about don't use a hammer to whatever. And that was what it.
But it doesn't change the fact they still don't know. They don't know the order.
But I think those are words. Those are kanji. Those are words. And they entered it in the order that the phrase goes.
But then why do they need the fingerprints in the infrared?
That is a very good point. But there is a bigger problem with this heist that I was wondering if you guys got. Did anybody
What's that?
Else? Okay, did you guys catch the problem with the atomic clock thing?
Probably. I don't know. Go ahead.
It went to 25. I know. It was weird.
No. Okay. So maybe I don't know how atomic clocks work, but her plan is that they need to steal an extra 10 seconds by faking out this clock to add a tenth of a second every minute, which means that every 10 minutes they get 1 second, right?
Yes,
correct. Yeah.
They set it to start an hour before they do the heist, which is 60 minutes, not 100 minutes. So they only buy 6 seconds. And like, I'm not good at math, and immediately I was like, wait, that can't be it. That can't be right.
No, atomic clock hours are 100 minutes. Everybody knows that. That's on you.
Do they operate in base six? I don't understand.
Oh, fuck. Oh, man. Oh, that makes me so happy. That makes me really happy. So then, despite the presence of crews and other security watching the building, the theft takes place in the final seconds.
I need help because Jessica, I think you hit on this earlier, and I just like, you know, in the kind of the fog of the idiocy of this movie, I just kind of allowed it to yada 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 over me. Why was Cruz there? Period. Question mark.
Well, this goes back to the problem of what the hell is Jin's actual plan? Because, like, is she still planning to turn Mac in at this point to Cruz? And why would she turn him into Cruz, who is nominally an insurance guy and no longer an FBI agent? None of it makes sense.
And I feel like the thing that, like, drives me nuts about this movie is, among a million other things, after the first heist, they both have the other one dead to rights if they want to turn the other one in. So this move, you know what I mean? Like, they've done a heist. Yep. Like, you can go to jail for that. So they've done a heist together, and if they're, you know, keeping records and holding out evidence, it's over. The only way this movie works at that point is if they mutually decide we are going to, you know, essentially go rogue and steal this money together and leave forever. But they don't. Like, Connery, if he does decide that, doesn't tell her until the movie's over. And goes through all the motions of, like, getting her arrested. None of this makes sense to me.
Yeah, in that respect.
But there is something, like, again, different actors, different directors, different everybody. There is something, like, inherently romantic with, you know, in a Mr. and Mrs. Smith kind of way, with two people, like, saying fuck you to your bosses, we love each other more than,
our job or money
or whatever we were into before we met each other. And I love Mr. and Mrs. Smith, like, mostly because of that. Like, that's, like, the kind of dynamic that'll get me every time. But this movie does not have that.
It's funny you bring up Mr. and Mrs. Smith, because I feel like that's also a perfect comparison, in the sense that that movie kind of doesn't make any sense either in its own way. Like, the end of that movie is kind of like, what? But the charm and the star wattage of these two leads, of Lyman's understanding of actual improvisation and getting that crackle, it doesn't matter, right? You're just like, this movie is a fucking blast and I love this and it's great. This movie is obviously the antithesis of that. This is when all of those things go wrong, and what you're left with is you have to focus on a story that makes no sense and is aggravating.
Yeah, I think a fundamental problem is that this movie cannot decide if it is a spy movie or a heist movie. And, like, the one keeps intruding on the other. If it was a spy movie, you could actually go that way with two of them and it would be a thing. But then, because they keep having to stop and spend 25 minutes explaining and setting up a heist, you never actually get to the conversations about what is going on with them emotionally or internally at all. So they just the genres just keep running into each other.
Well, I think that speaks to a little bit of, I don't know this for a fact, but I do think that speaks to the fact that you have two screenwriters that didn't work together, right? So what you have is sort of, you know, Ron Bass does what he does, and then Broyles does what he does, and the two don't ever fully gel. And there's a part of me that feels like, and I'm sure when open writing assignments or script doctorings or whatever, when a writer is brought in, they're generally brought in to focus on a specific storyline or a specific element rather than the thing as a whole. And that's why movies like this, where they feel piecemeal, they feel like certain things are written by certain people and it never actually feels like it's a camel, basically. It sucks.
Yeah.
So then at this point, Jin pulls the plug on her laptop prematurely and sets off the alarms.
Also not sure how or why or what causes that.
Yep. Don't worry about it.
Seems like such an oversight on their behalf.
Yes, I would agree. They narrowly escape the computer vault and are forced to cross the lights hung from the bottom of the bridge linking the two towers. This was a really stupid action scene because it didn't really make any physical sense, which kind of bothered me. Like, I'm not really sure why all of a sudden this cable starts to fray. I also, did you guys feel like, so forgive me because this is a little bit logistical and stupid, but there is the bolt thing that attaches the cable to the bridge. And then that piece flies off and wedges itself between two beams. But the way that it's wedged there looks so loosely done that they would just have plummeted to their death. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Did you feel this way, or did I pay too much attention?
I stopped caring at that point.
Okay, cool. That's fine. I just wanted to put it out there.
I mean, what I didn't understand was, like, they have parachutes. Why did they not just jump out of the building?
Just use them. Yeah. Fuck me. Yeah. Seriously.
What was the plan once they got to the other side of the tower? There were also agents over there.
Yep. It also comes back to your teleporting theory that you both have, because when they're both dangling from this thing, right? It's more Jessica's. Yeah, sorry. And Connery is holding Catherine Zeta-Jones. They're dangling from this, basically over the precipice of what looks like, I don't know, several hundreds of feet over Malaysia. And then it just kind of cuts away to them just climbing back up. Like, you never really see the actual physical, like, rescue component of it. They only show the danger. It's so strange. It's like they just didn't have a shot of it or something. I don't know.
I was also super annoyed that at this point it's like 25 minutes after midnight on the Millennium and suddenly a fireworks show starts behind them. And it's like, did you guys not get the memo? Is there a time zone thing 25 minutes after, like, over there in sight? Good.
It's fantastic. Yeah. So then we have the moment where Jin gets basically, they lose one of the fucking parachutes, and he gives her one and says, meet me at the train station the next day. And she says and cries, but I don't know when I'm ever going to see you again, or some bullshit like that. So I'm going to read just this final portion of what happens at the train station, just so we have it, and then we can explain why it makes no sense. Jin arrives at the station waiting for Mac. He shows up late with Ving Rhames, who reveals himself with fellow FBI agents. He explains that Cruz is here and that the FBI have been looking for him for some time. 2 years ago, when Ving Rhames caught and arrested Mac, he made a deal to help the FBI arrest Jin, who was the primary target all along. However, the aging thief has another plan, which is to help her escape. Mac slips Jin a gun and quietly explains that he returned only 7 of the $8 billion they had stolen electronically in the heist. Jin then pretends to hold Mac hostage at gunpoint, threatening to shoot him if the agents follow her. She boards a train. The FBI heads to the next station. Jin jumps the train mid-station and arrives back and says to Mac she needs his help for another job, and they both board the train.
Yeah.
That's it. You explain why it makes no sense.
Also, there's the part where Mac bribes Ving Rhames with the 5 data chips that she stole out of the stupid vase in the heist.
Fuck, I forgot that.
And it's not clear, like, is he giving those to the FBI? Is Ving Rhames corrupt and is going to sell those? Like, he just bribes an FBI agent.
Also, yes to all of that. And also, why would they give a fuck if she shot Mac? Or shoot both of them in the legs. Like, I don't, this idea that, like, threatening, like, putting a gun to Mac's head all of a sudden is, like, their brilliant getaway plan is mind-numbingly stupid.
Well, I also just go back to, she's been working in an insurance company for 5 years under an FBI agent. Why did they not arrest her during any of that time?
Yeah. Kenny, you were going to say something?
He didn't have to explain the entire plot to her.
Nope.
I know that he had to explain the entire plot to us, so I get that. But, like, if you're going to have someone explain the entire plot to you, you got to do it better than, like, in a moment of, like, duress and urgency in hushed tones while he's given a minute to say goodbye. What? So, like, he could have just slipped her the gun, and she could have held the gun to his head, and there could have been a more cinematic way to explain what had happened, or just don't. Like, I got it. I got it at the end. Like, he turned on her. If I saw the gun exchange, I would have figured it all out, you know, and I'm not, like, I'm pretty bad at this when it comes down to, like, figuring fucking plots out, so.
Yeah. And she also, the gun never gets used.
But can I also say, too?
I know.
What I was going to say as well, to to piggyback on your point, Kenny, of like, why explain it to us? I also don't give a fuck. So just get me out of the movie faster. Like, just, yeah. That's the thing that's maybe perhaps one of the more annoying parts of this end of this movie is that it's about 10 to 15 minutes. Like, it should have been 5. Anyway.
I mean, the whole movie, ideally, should have been 5.
Do we want to rate this, Kenny? Do you want to rate this movie?
Yeah.
Go for it. You're first.
All right. So, I mean, sadly for me, I gave this movie a 28 before the podcast, which is bad.
Oh,
quite
wow.
Quite bad.
Okay.
But not that bad. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give it a 12. I think it is one of the worst movies we've done. I thought that was the kind of rating I was giving it, but there's absolutely nothing redeeming about it. And, you know, the movie makes me kind of mad during it. And then, like, the milk thing and the revelation about me. we got to bring it down to 12 for psychiatric pills. You guys go ahead.
The milk thing. Fuck. That's fantastic. Oh God, that's really funny. I'm similar. I didn't see this in 99. I'm similarly around where you are, Kenny. I had it at about a 19 or a 20 before we sat down, but I'm at a 13 now. I mean, I'm you know, this is, I would say, you know, we have some bottom barrel movies, right? Like, we have Love Stinks, which is the nadir of this podcast, and Broke Kenny for all intents and purposes. So, like, Love, it's going to be hard to beat Love Stinks, I think, in terms of badness, but. This isn't chill factor. Love Stinks is the worst. Yeah, no, Love Stinks.
Yeah,
this isn't in sort of, this is in chill factor territory of how did you fuck this up? This was a layup, you know.
I don't know which is worse. I gave chill factor a 3.
You
I
did.
Think chill.
You did.
Yes, but that was early in the podcast, and I think I was trying to flex a little bit. I think chill factor. Chill factor is so unapologetically boring and miserable and stupid and not fun.
Yes.
Anyway, at least we had a really good time talking about this movie on the podcast. So like there is some fun to be had here.
Yeah. What did you think, Jessica? You saw this in 99. So what are your thoughts then? And what are your thoughts now?
I mean, I don't have any strong memory of the film. Like, I remember I was a big Ebert devotee, so going to see it on that recommendation and being like, that was kind of garbage. So, I mean, I would say probably because I was 17 and hadn't seen a lot of movies at the time, I would have called it like, this is out of 100, right?
99.
Out of 99. I would call it like maybe a 30. Because I didn't know anything about movies.
So like a 31 out of 100.
Yeah, but definitely, definitely now I would say, probably around 10 or 12. There's nothing good. There's not an element you can point to and be like, that was well done. Good job, wigs department. Yep. Like nothing.
Well,
no one gets their job.
Let's
though, do. Let's too much money.
Let's do that for a second.
Wigs department?
No, not the wigs department. If you had, if you were forced, it's like, you know, it's like when for is a baseball thing, right? But like, Jessica, are you a baseball fan? I feel like you are
mildly.
So I, you know, every year for the All-Star game, every team has to have an All-Star. And as a Mets fan, it's been very funny sometimes who's been our all-star, you know, like because it's usually like some relief pitcher who has like a 2.7 ERA and like is barely a bright spot on the season. Who would be the one all-star if you had to say something about this movie? You're like, all right, we have no choice but to put up some representation for this movie that we think like is not all bad. Is there anything there?
It's a good question.
Locations,
very good question.
I will say, maybe. Ooh. Like, they were not shot well, but like Kuala Lumpur was not a big shooting location in the 90s. So that was kind of now it feels a little more trite to use those towers, but then it seemed like, wow, that's a cool thing. And the castle is a cool place. Like,
great choice.
I don't know. Bottom of barrel.
Great choice.
That's right. I mean, that might be the best answer. I mean, I'll say this. I mean, I guess similarly, I'd probably say maybe cinematography. I mean, like it's shot relatively well. You know, like it's got, I guess, enough of a slickness to it. That or, I mean, I wanted to say Ving Rhames, but he's so unengaged in this movie.
I was waiting for him because I knew he was in the movie and I was like, oh, well, that'll be a breath of relief. He's always a lot of fun. And he was nothing.
I know you have two Oscar winners are the stars of this movie, right? Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones. Ving Rhames is like, I believe, a Juilliard trained actor who's like won Golden Globes and Emmys.
And it's great. Can be great.
And Will Patton was in Armageddon. So like you have the best of the bunch here.
And remember the Titans.
And
he's great in that.
Will Patton is, I was just joking. Will Patton's all right. And Maury Chaykin.
Yeah, I like Will Patton.
But no, the joke is like, you know, Catherine Zeta-Jones won hers for a musical, and Sean Connery won his because everyone thought it'd be really cute to give an award to James Bond. And I love The Untouchables, but like, come on, you know? So that's the end of the story. But Ving Rhames is a great actor.
Ving Rhames is great. This is just, I mean, the literally the word that comes to mind when I think of this film is just fucking lazy. Like, no one brought their A game. Everyone just fucking phoned it in. It's lazy in every department. And it's embarrassing. Like, I wish that not to belabor the point, but you know, I really love some of Ron Bass's movies. I think that he is absolutely capable and has proven himself to write great scripts. I think that William Broyles is also a very good screenwriter. I don't understand how this happened.
Sometimes it just
happens. But it did. Yeah, it just happens. So next week we're doing the Pokemon movie. Jessica, have you seen the Pokemon movie?
I have not.
Are you a Pokemon fan?
I have absolutely no knowledge of Pokemon. I don't know how I've avoided it.
I'm right there with you, Jessica.
But it is a large blank spot in my pop culture knowledge.
I feel similarly, like I've failed myself somehow because people love it.
Well, you have.
So are we going to be doing Pokemon the movie 2000?
Correct. Pokemon 2000.
It's Pokemon the movie 2000. Come on, have some respect. But Jessica, I also have limited knowledge, but I have children, so I've seen some Pokemon. When you think of Pokemon, knowing nothing except for its cultural impact, what do you think? And what's your commentary on that?
All right. Here are the things I know about Pokemon. Pikachu is cute.
Yeah, true.
There is something called Jigglypuff, and I don't know what it is, but I like that name.
It is another Pokemon.
And it caused a lot of people to mill around the park near my house for several months when the game came out where you hunt them or whatever. Werner Herzog had an amazing take on Pokemon where he was asking if like you're able to murder them. And I'm going to just let that inform my view of the entire franchise. That's what it is. It's about really cute anime creatures murdering each other.
That is what it is.
That's why they needed a detective.
I wish that I liked Detective Pikachu more. I saw Detective Pikachu knowing very little about Pokemon. And I thought it would be more fun than it was.
Here's my feeling on Detective Pikachu.
Yeah.
Because my son, my eldest son, who is 8, went through a Pokemon period around 5, 6, was obsessed. So I was up enough on Pokemon to be able to understand what's happening in that movie to some extent. If you didn't know anything about Pokemon, like it sounds like you guys know nothing about it,
it's literally impossible to understand what's happening in that movie. there was no attempt to make this a mass product, which they could have. And I think they could have done it in a way that didn't alienate the core fans. But it does feel like, you know, like for instance, I've now seen the Sonic movie like 5 times and I have very little like
– Is it good?
Yeah, because it's very fucking easy to see what they're doing there. And like the concession made to the fans was the right move. But they didn't go too far into Sonic lore, because if you go too far into Sonic lore, you realize like this is – video game shit they made up on the fly because of what was easy to animate. So like, don't like get too deep into this shit in the first movie, you know? But that's kind of the end of my life.
I strongly disagree with your take on the Sonic movie. That's all I'm going to say.
Oh shit. No. Let's hear it.
Well, I have not seen the movie. I had to cover the script. I don't understand why it was a Sonic movie. You spend no time in Sonic's world, which is the thing that everybody loves about Sonic, is all the cool like zones you go to in the games.
Whoa,
like,
you're too all in on Sonic.
Nobody cares about Sonic the character. He has no character. Like, you care that it's pretty. And the movie was a road trip in a truck.
That's so funny.
I totally failed to understand it. I respect Pokemon for being like, no, we are not making this accessible to non-fans. Like, that's ballsy.
I'll say this about the Sonic movie, which I haven't seen, which I do kind of want to see because I actually really loved playing Sonic when I was a kid. I agree with you, Jessica, that like a big part of the game is the worlds, right? Like it's the visual component of Sonic. I'm not invested in Sonic like I'm invested in like Link or Zelda or something like that. Like there's no character really to speak of. But I also kind of respect the 90s acknowledgement of getting Jim Carrey and like basically feeling from what I've heard like a 90s movie, which is sort of endearing in its own way. I don't know.
I think that there's a reason that Sonic is like by far the most successful video game adaptation of all time.
Yeah.
And I think it's because it wasn't made for the hardcore fans. I think it's super accessible. And Jessica, I don't want to give anything away, but they certainly hint towards a more world infused movie in the sequel.
Well, yeah, then I'll watch that movie. But they need a 2-hour prologue to get to the good shit.
But I think my point is, I think America needed the 2-hour prologue. I think the world needed the 2-hour prologue.
That's so good.
So yeah, I don't know. I was actually quite impressed with Sonic, given how horrible almost every video game movie ever made is.
What would you say is a good one outside of that? Outside of Sonic,
because like there's never been a good one, but Mortal Kombat's the best.
People love Mortal Kombat. I mean, Street Fighter is terrible. Super Mario Brothers is terrible.
Terrible.
It's tough. That's why this Halo TV show, I'm just like, I don't get it, guys.
No, there's never been a good one, and there's only been really bad ones. And like ones that like very like Doom should have been good. It's not that fucking hard to make a good Doom movie, it feels like. Or I think there was a Duke Nukem movie. Like these things like, you know,
these
like,
should
there
be
could
layups.
Be, there could be a Wolfenstein movie. There could be a Myst movie. Like these things, Link, you know, I think Zelda would do a horrible job Game of Thrones. Thronesifying it and making it just fucking unwatchable. But like, there's obviously, you know, the bones of a good Link movie.
I have to say, I mean, it was garbage and not a good movie, but just in terms of it was fun and exactly what I was asking for from it, the Rampage movie was pretty fun.
I've seen that too. And I think that
it was wildly stupid, but kind of fun.
Also, it's like they did a really good job, like realizing that we have, you know, essentially we have three monsters and that's all we need to take from this game.
Yep.
You know, like,
you know, it's so cool funny. It's really interesting. Like, the three of us have, you know, spent, I don't know, probably 10 minutes talking about video game movies. And when you think about how shockingly lucrative video games are. Like it is a staggering amount of money. And that no one has been able to really capitalize on it is mind blowing to me.
Go ahead, Kenny.
No, no, please.
I think it has to do with the way narrative is treated in video games versus films. Like you can't capture the ability to be in an avatar as you are in video games the way you do in a movie and have it be a good movie, because protagonists need to have a personality. And most mm-hmm. game avatars don't, or at least they give you enough leeway that you identify so strongly with the character that, like, I don't know. There's something about the way narrative structure works between the twos that does not compute.
I was going to say a version of the same thing. You know, it like it's a step backwards. It would be like it would be like taking your favorite movie and then saying, we're turning this into, you know, we're doing a podcast version of this. And for you to feel like that is as, you know, enthralling or engaging as a movie, or in this case, you know, as a video game.
Do you think it has anything to do with, and again, I'm not a video game person, so forgive my ignorance, but the video games that I've played for the most part, you know, the big part of a video game is in the world building, right? Like quite literally in the world that you're inhabiting. And it's not so much the characters, right? Like character development is just not important. So what I'm kind of surprised at is that considering, like, look at a movie like Warcraft, right? Like, I mean, they had world building on world building to work with, and yet they still couldn't find a way to, you know, to translate that to the screen. It's kind of shocking to me.
Do you know how
it also tends to not work in reverse? You rarely get good video games made off of movie properties.
Right. Also true. Yes.
Do you know how people almost always say that the book is better than the movie when they've read the book first?
Yep.
Because they've already imagined the best possible version of the movie for themselves. In a situation like Warcraft, like these people have already, like big Warcraft players, or my son's a huge Minecraft guy now. He's already done more Minecraft shit in like the 18 months he's been playing than any movie can come close to doing in an hour and a half. And it would necessarily be a disappointment for him. He would necessarily walk out and say, that was like watching a baby play Minecraft. When he spends, you know, time on YouTube watching these, like, you know, engineering guru genius people do things like you can't even believe. So I think that there's some element.
I totally hear that.
But I do feel like, to your point about character, part of the reason, and again, I'm not trying to pick a fight, Jessica, but part of the reason Sonic worked is because they took him out of his world. Like, I have this idea, and again, it may never work because it's a video game, but like, I want to do a show or a movie, it's a show about Little Mac from the Mike Tyson's Punch-Out series. The movie wouldn't be, you know, the Mike Tyson's Punch-Out series or Punch-Out is a very simple game. You're only in the ring. That's all it is. But I see something compelling or like kind of naturally there in an underdog story, like an undersized boxer and what you can do with that outside of the ring. And that's where I would set that movie.
That's cool.
And I think that like there is something to that. Like I think a Link movie would be potentially really cool if they didn't just try to graft the Zelda lore onto Game of Thrones, which is what I fear they would do.
Well, can I just want to say one last thing, because I think, and it kind of encapsulates both, kind of everybody's theories on this a little bit, because what you just said about Rollins playing Minecraft makes me think about the fact that when you're playing this game, there are levels of complexity going on in terms of the fact that you're creating the narrative, or in Minecraft, you're creating the worlds, whatever the case might be, right? So to translate that to the screen, it has to be simplified, because obviously studios want it to apply to as many people as possible. So the universality of trying to then take this video game where you've gone on this complex journey and then reducing it down to something that everybody can do in order to make it into a film, you're losing that specialness of the thing that you've gone through. Like, it's like you're trying to sort of, it's square peg round hole shit, but it's also like you're taking something that's far more interesting and making it less interesting to apply to more people. And then when you've done that, what you're left with is just not much of anything. It's very strange.
Is also to a time limit issue. Like, video games would probably make better TV adaptations because a lot of video games are 40 to 50 hours long, and you can't make that an hour and a half movie and have it be at all comprehensible. And I think that's where a lot of the adaptations of like RPGs and big world games, like what was the one we were talking about earlier?
Warcraft?
Yeah, Warcraft. Sorry. Wanted to say Warhammer. That's different. fall down is that it does not really bring in the scope of the world, and people want the scope of the world. That's what's interesting.
Then maybe Halo is the answer. I doubt it is, but maybe it is.
that project has been around forever.
Forever. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, listen, years, who the hell knows? Something like that, yeah.
But I do agree with you, Jessica. I think that video games, it's interesting because a couple years ago, my managers brought up Final Fantasy to me because I guess they've been trying to do that as a TV show. And it was way, way outside my purview. So I obviously didn't do anything with it, but it did make me think like maybe that is what needs to happen to these games because the expanse of them is just so overwhelming that to shrink it down just not only doesn't do its service, but actually like makes a bad product.
So apparently people do like the Resident Evil movies. I've never seen one, but
I've seen the first one.
I think there is a fan base for them.
Yep.
But before we go,
I think they cracked the code with that one in terms of budget. I think that Paul W.S. Anderson understood how to make them cheap and, you know,
and there's been I think that does start to scratch the surface of what Jessica's talking about in terms of like
totally
different adventures and different worlds. But before we go, I want to hit on something Jessica said earlier. It might not have been in this version of the podcast. As you know, this was our third attempt. But it was just in the back of my mind. Because of the J.J. Abrams thing, I'm so compelled to ask your take on Lost because you said I've seen Lost. And I think that there's been like, over the last year or so, as it's like come up on the 10th anniversary, there's been this reappraisal, particularly of the finale, by critics and people online trying to convince me that it was good when it was really the worst. So, what's your take, Jessica?
I mean, I loved the first season. I was completely hooked and I thought it was great and I thought the character building was great and I thought the world they were setting up was really interesting, and then from the second season on it became evident that there was no plan and that they were doing this more or less on the fly. This became more concrete to me when I was at a Q&A with J.J. Abrams when he did Star Trek, and somebody asked him a question about Lost, and he said that like they pitched Lost, like they wanted to pitch another script, and the executives, I guess at ABC or the production company, I can't remember, were like, no, we want you to give us a take about an airplane, something about an airplane. We don't know. So they wrote the Lost pitch as like a fine, let's do this to make these guys happy. We don't want to do this. And then they'll shut up and we can focus on what we want to make. Mm-hmm. And that kind of summarizes the show for me because they wrote a very tight season and then there was just nothing. There was no plan. And like, if you're determined to find gold in a production that is made by competent people and good actors and people that are working very hard, you can always find like some aspects of it that are good and that you can claim like redeem the show. But I don't think anybody with any level of experience writing thinks that they knew what the hell they were doing or that they successfully pulled it off. Like, it is so obviously by the seat of your pants writing.
Which, like, I would say that's okay to some extent, except, and this is where I agree with you, except the promise of this show was answers. And I don't need answers. You know, that's not what I mean. But I don't mean like giving me an answer for everything. What I mean is when you go on a journey with a show,
and this is more, you know, akin to movies, but with a show like Lost that very clearly states, I think, very early on, this is a bigger world. There's a lot of stuff going on here. And just let me take you by the hand. And this is going to work out because I have a plan. And they very clearly don't at the end of the day, or maybe they did and the plan was so underwhelming, because I mean, I think it's plausible that their plan was there in purgatory and everyone figured that out about three episodes into the first season. But I agree. I think that they set their own expectation level really high, and it's not my fault or your fault or the fault of the audience that we bought into it. That's why the show was so exciting.
Well, that's the other thing that bothered. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Phil.
I was just going to say that I think that I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth here, but I think you'll understand what I mean in a second. You know, I am not a person who generally subscribes to the idea of it's the journey, not the destination. I don't love that. You know, when a show doesn't stick the landing, it certainly tarnishes the journey that you've been on.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I wish that I could tell you why, and I really don't know why. For some reason, with this show, that's kind of how I fall on it. I enjoyed the hell out of it so much, and it didn't stick the landing, and it didn't answer all of my questions. But I'm kind of okay with it. And I can't really tell you why. And perhaps it's because I remember just moments of that show where I was just like, this show can do fucking anything. And I'm so excited by the potential of it. And the ride was just so much fun that the fact that it didn't totally stick the landing didn't bother me. But I totally understand where you guys are coming from. And I have similar feelings about basically every other television show that fails. So
what were you going to say, Jessica?
I think there's something about the filmmaking in Lost, and it's part of my issue with J.J. Abrams and just like mystery boxing in general, is there's a cynicism and almost a cruelty in the part of the filmmaker who intentionally tries to get you to not to misdirect you into thinking something is important, but that's really a cover for this other thing that's important, but who tries to trap you into thinking something is important and then is like, ha, no, idiot, you were wrong to even care about that. Like, that is mean. That's cynical. That's abusing your audience instead of like bringing them on a journey where there's all sorts of interesting surprises that lead to new things. This was just like, this was more like having zombies jump out at you at an open house or like a haunted house and then being, and then laughing at you for being startled by that. I don't know. It really bothers me on like an existential level.
I get that.
That's totally fair.
Yeah, I agree with, and I hear what all you guys are saying, both you guys, and I agree with pretty much everything. Like to some extent, Phil, I feel that way about Lost, right? Like yeah. I have great love for Lost. Like I will always have great love for Lost, mostly because of what you said. Like the lack of rules and the lack of like form, and it was an exciting watch every week, and there's something to be said for that. I was super let down by the ending, mostly because they set my expectations high, and I don't really understand the argument that I don't understand the argument that basically feels like, God bless Damon Lindelof, who's done so many amazing things, but it basically feels like a lot of people feeling bad about the way they treated Damon Lindelof. It feels like a pat on the head nowadays. So there's that aspect to it. To your point, Jessica, I agree with you too. Like, I don't mind being manipulated, or I don't mind being led astray if that is the point of view of the character with whom I'm supposed to be identifying. Right? I want to experience. Yeah. I want to experience the journey the way the characters do. So when sometimes, I mean, if that's the intent of the piece. So when, you know, they hear the French woman over the thing, or when they, you know, see a polar bear or whatever, like, yeah, like, and those things ultimately don't matter that much. They matter a little, and there's, you know, there's an element there. But I think the moment they started building this world out to include Ben and include the Dharma Initiative and include the real world and include, you know, literal God and the devil –
was the moment that it stopped feeling like you were with the characters and more like you were with a bunch of people who didn't know what they were doing. And that was really,
yeah, you know, no, I agree. I don't have problems.
I
don't have a problem.
Listen, I completely agree with you. I understand where you're coming from.
I lost her. Did you guys lose her?
Yeah, I think we lost her.
I can hear you guys. I don't. Oh, you can't hear me.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Start from. No, I don't have a problem.
Now. Go ahead. I don't have a problem.
Okay. I don't have a problem with stories that keep you as ignorant as your protagonist, as long as you're going along with them. But like when the show jumps between that and this weird omniscient point of view.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's something about it that it wasn't like you were on the level of the characters. Like you said, it's that you were deliberately being tricked by the filmmakers.
Which is why I really, you know, have such a knee-jerk reaction with everything Dan Fogelman does. Because that's how his movies, yep, and TV shows feel. It feels like they only exist to trick the audience. They don't exist to actually tell a story the way any human being would tell the story unless they were an asshole.
I agree with you 100%, Kenny. I would also, to piggyback on that and say that, you know, when you put JJ, I think that JJ ultimately is trying to entertain his audience as much as is humanly possible. Like, I think that when everything is said and done, all he cares about is that you're having a good time and that you're engaged with the material that he's putting in front of you for however long that is. And he'll figure out what the next episode is when he has to. But ultimately, he wants you to have a fun time on this moment that's happening in front of you. Now, the problem with that, to both of your points, is that if it's just a mystery box and he's just shaking an interesting, you know, toy in front of you and there's nothing behind it, then it feels, obviously, it feels hollow and it feels as though you're just being jerked around.
Yeah.
Should we wrap this up?
That feels like a good place to.
JJ Abrams sucks. Let's.
Jessica, we cannot go this long next time because I love having you on it. I love the, you know, the tangents we take. I think it's so much fun. Same. So,
yeah.
Thank you. I love coming on.
We really honestly had a blast. You need to come back far sooner.
I will send you a list of the worst movies ever made.
Thank you. No, excellent. Maybe some porn would be good. That would be a logical step here.
Oh my God, that's funny. Yeah, we're going to have you back. It's going to be great. But thank you so much for coming on, Jess. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys. 99 podcasts like it. You want a podcast like it.
1999. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.